Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. According to BlackLivesMatter.com, it's not a moment, it's a movement, and it's exploding. On Monday, 250 protesters surrounded the Oakland police headquarters. 25 people were arrested. Also on Monday, over 50 black men dressed in suits and ties gathered in front of the federal courthouse in downtown Los Angeles for a silent vigil supporting black men killed by police. Kerman Maddox, managing partner at Dakota Communications and organizer of the Suits in Solidarity Vigil, told the LA Times that, quote, the larger community doesn't know how common it is for African-American men to be stopped and harassed, end quote. He said the men in suits gathered to show support for youth who've been protesting across the country. And then on Tuesday, more than 100 lawyers and law students staged a die-in outside of the Los Angeles courthouse. Signs said, the system is guilty. And today, public defenders in Oakland, Contra Costa, San Jose, San Francisco, and Santa Clara counties are hosting rallies, the first of its kind. Black Lives Matter and I Can't Breathe are the words being used by people across the country. On July 17th, Eric Garner said, I can't breathe 11 times as police placed him in a chokehold and then pinned him to the ground. A grand jury decided not to charge a New York police officer for causing Garner's death. So on today's Your Call, we are talking about how citizens plan to keep the momentum going. It seems like there are new actions almost weekly, definitely weekly, but almost daily. What is the end goal and what will it take to get there? Today, we are joined by Kat Brooks, co-chair of the Onyx Organizing Committee. Onyx is an African liberation organization dedicated to the empowerment of people of color. Kat has participated in a number of actions, including the BART shutdown and the four-hour occupation of the Oakland Police Department. Hi, Kat. Welcome back to the show.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Great to have you. Claudia Pena is statewide director of the California Civil Rights Coalition, which works to transform the nation's consciousness on race through law, social science, and the arts. Claudia participated in a recent lawyer die-in on the courthouse steps in Los Angeles as an attorney not representing her organization. Hi, Claudia. Welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Great to have you. And Wazi Moret Davis is violence prevention educator at Youth Alive, an organization that works to prevent violence and develop youth leadership, and a student at SF State. Wazi has helped organize the Black Brunch and shut down OPD direct actions. Hi, Wazi. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Becca. Thanks for having me.
It's great to have you. So, Kat, I want to start off with you. I mean, it's almost impossible to keep up with what's happening. I mean, if you Google Black Lives Matter, there are just so many actions. Last week, 70 medical students were involved. Students either walked out, staged die-ins, did protests. As I said, today, public defenders are hosting rallies. According to media reports, this has never happened before. What really strikes you about the momentum that we're seeing? Kat?
Yes, can you hear me?
Yes, go ahead.
I think what we're seeing now, I believe in my heart, is that we are either on the precipice of or in the early stages of the next largest social justice movement of this country. I think what you're seeing is an awakening of people to something that black folks have known for a long time, and that is the war being waged in our communities by police, who often, rather than being in our communities to protect and serve, are an occupying army.
Claudia, what really strikes you about what you're seeing? You participated in the lawyer die-in on the courthouse steps in Los Angeles earlier this week.
Yeah, I mean, it's exciting to see the movement spreading not only across the country, but there's also global support. I mean, there have been actions in Brazil and in France in support of Black Lives Matter in the U.S., and it's good to see because that is what will affect real change, right? Folks out in the streets and actions taking place all over communities across the United States, that's what's going to force decision makers to bring real change to our neighborhoods and our communities. And I think Kat is right. I think that we are on the precipice of something really big. And it's interesting because she's right. This has been happening for a long time. Black folks know that this is what's been going on. And then there are advocates and lawyers and civil rights attorneys who have been working on these things for 30 years, 60 years. But this is the moment. Because of the movement, because of people in the streets, this is the moment where we can actually get the change that we need.
I'm glad you brought up the international response because Newsweek had a piece last week about worldwide actions in Tokyo, Paris, Delhi, and so many of the signs say, America, we're watching.
Yeah, and that's so inspiring. I mean, it gives me chills because Americans and especially American leaders tend to think that, you know, we stand on the moral high ground on the global scale, that we are the ones with democracy and we are the ones that have the most progressive laws. But in fact, people all over the world know that in many ways it's a facade, right? Especially black communities in the U.S. know that that's a lie, and that the veil is being lifted off of that lie, and now the whole world is watching, and we better do right.
Mm. I also didn't mention athletes, but athletes are also wearing I Can't Breathe t-shirts. A number of women's basketball teams are now getting involved. Wazi, what are your thoughts on the momentum, and why do you think this is really gaining so much traction?
Yeah, thanks. I think that people are honestly, just to echo what Kat was saying, people are waking up to a lot of things. People are tired, you know. And again, this is, obviously not something new. You know, black folks have been, we've been fighting this war against black bodies for 400 years, right? And I think what's happening now is that, you know, there seems to be, from what I see, it seems like there's a lot more exposure that's happening in the media now, in these different ways, right? And I think that definitely, the generation that we're in is having, an effect on just the way that information is able to be disseminated to different communities now, right? And so with, even with social media, with Facebook, with Twitter, these messages, these really empowering messages and important messages are getting out to many, many more people, I think, and getting out to people much faster, than they have been in the past. And at the same time, this is, again, it's the momentum is something that we've seen happen historically with different types of civil rights movements, different types of movements. But I think that, just with the added media and social media, I think that's certainly, helping to get these messages out a lot faster today.
Yeah, I mean, I was struck by the medical students, just really amazing photos. I'm not sure if any of you saw this, but there was a group of seven black Harvard medical students, and they were standing with the black hoodies and then the white medical coats, and they had a sign that said, "They tried to bury us. They didn't know we were seeds." And this happened on International Human Rights Day last Wednesday. Students at over 70 medical schools walked out together in protest. And the statement says, quote, "We feel it's essential to begin a conversation about our role in addressing the explicit and implicit discrimination and racism in our communities and reflect on the systemic biases embedded in our medical education, curricula, clinical learning environments, and administrative decision making," end quote. What was interesting about this, Claudia, is they really focused on the public health aspect of this.
Yeah, isn't that fantastic? I mean, it's so important for people to recognize how racism interacts and intersects with all the systems of oppression, right? Racism leads to medical health issues. Racism leads to unemployment. Racism leads to an overrepresentation with the criminal justice system. I mean, it permeates everything, and it's really important for all these different industries and disciplines to start connecting those dots and standing up against it so that we can finally address the racism that's rampant in the United States.
And Claudia, as a lawyer, what goes through your mind when you hear that public defenders in five Northern California counties are hosting rallies today? I mean, nothing like this has ever happened.
I mean, it's incredible, and many of my friends are organizing those, so it's exciting. It's important for public defenders, lawyers, and I really wish district attorneys would get out there as well, because we are caught up in the system, right? It's the legal structure, it's the criminal justice system that is causing many of the issues that we're looking at. It's the criminal justice system that's allowing police officers to behave in these ways without impunity, right? These grand juries that are not indicting, and even when there are indictments, many times the punishment is minuscule in comparison to the behavior. So because we are the ones that are caught up in the system, it's important for us to call it out. As legal actors, we're sworn to enforce the laws, we're sworn to uphold them, and so we have a special obligation to also challenge them, to make it clear to everybody else that we do not stand by this. We are lawyers, we're trained as lawyers, and we know this is not right.
That is Claudia Pena, statewide director of the California Civil Rights Coalition, which works to transform the nation's consciousness on race. And she participated in a recent lawyer die-in on the courthouse steps in Los Angeles. We're also joined by Kat Brooks, co-chair of the Onyx Organizing Committee and African Liberation Organization. Wazi Moret Davis is violence prevention educator at Youth Alive and a student at San Francisco State. Wazi helped organize the Black Brunch and shut down OPD direct actions in Oakland, and we'll talk about that also on today's show. Today we are talking about the Black Lives Matter movement, which is exploding. It seems like there's a new action happening every day. What really strikes you about what you are seeing in this movement? If you're taking part, how are you taking part? What do you think is most effective? What are the end goals of this movement? What will it take to get there? And I've been hearing people say, well, what should take place so Black Lives Matter doesn't turn out like Occupy, where, depending on how you look at it, the movement either cannibalized itself or sort of disintegrated. Of course, there's still a lot of action around Occupy, but definitely not what we saw at the height of Occupy. So we'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Why do you think this movement has struck such a chord with such a wide range of people, from athletes to medical students? I told you about the men in suits in Los Angeles who are taking part in this. A second grade class walked out this week. I mean, it's just hitting so many different people. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website. Kat, how do you answer that question? A lot of people wonder, what will ultimately happen to Black Lives Matter? How can we make sure that what happened to Occupy doesn't happen to Black Lives Matter?
Well, I think the first thing to really talk about is that this is larger than Black Lives Matter, and this is really a movement, right, of Black people and folks in solidarity to forever change the way Black people are treated in this country, and the police are one element of that. And I think the other thing to highlight is that, similar to the civil rights movement that exploded in the 60s and 70s, the work for that movement happened in the 20s and the 30s and the 40s. And the ground for what's happening right now has been being laid out over the last 10, 15, 20 years. So what you're seeing is the culmination of a lot of mini movements. You know, here in the Bay Area, we had Oscar Grant, which was huge in terms of shifting the way people demonstrated against police terrorism in this country. I think when you're talking about the movement that exists today and Occupy, you're really talking about apples and oranges, right? I mean, they're two completely different movements. And even in Oakland, the Occupy movement here was very different than it was across the country. I think what we're seeing now is, in this movement, is a lot of militancy, a lot of discipline, a lot of communication, and a lot of accountability. And that is one thing that was very different than Occupy, which was very much about no hierarchy, nobody's in charge, we're all collectively in charge, and therefore you had no real accountability. Hmm. So those are two very clear differences in terms of sustainability. You can't bring order, you can't create order from chaos. You've got to lay the foundation and structure and have accountability amongst each other. So you've got at least two of us, myself and Wazi, right, that are in this process and doing this work in different arenas in the same community, but we're in communication. Right? So Black Lives Matter and Black Brunch and Onyx and the Blackout Collective, and then these conversations are happening nationally. So Ferguson is talking to Oakland, is talking to New York, is talking to Atlanta, is talking to Chicago. And those are some very big differences between what we're creating or participating in with the people and what happened with Occupy.
Wazi, what are your thoughts on how to keep the momentum going?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I totally agree with everything that Kat was bringing up. And I think that, you know, one thing in particular with the group of folks who have been organizing, you know, around Black Brunch, around Blackout Collective, something that people have expressed that they really appreciate about our movement is that they are strategic with every move. And I think that in order to remain sustainable, you also have to be intentional with every move that you make, with every message that you send, with every action or whatever that you're about to set up. It has to be intentional. And, you know, I honestly was living on the East Coast when the whole Occupy movement was happening out here. But from what I've heard, you know, as far as feedback-wise, I'm not sure what the intention was there, the real deep intention was there from a lot of the male hierarchy leaders that were, you know, kind of in charge there. And really here, it's more about like Chad said, militancy. It's more strategic and being organized and working collectively in order to sustain the movement. And that's going to show up in a lot of different ways, right? It's not just going to look like marching. It's not just going to look like protesting. You know, we're very strategic in the way that we're thinking about how we want to disrupt the system, because the system is what is, you know, keeping us down. The system is what keeps on oppressing us. And so until we do away with that, you know, we're still going to continue to face these different forms of violence. And so I think that there are many different ways to disrupt the system that we've been talking about, both short-term direct action and long-term wise, right, in order to create better communities. And so to me, that's what really sustainability is all about, is intention, you know, both in the short-term vision and in the long-term vision for what you have for your community.
And Wazi, there was a piece in the East Bay Express by Will Butler, News Media Ignores Black Protests. He's specifically focusing on protests that didn't involve, like, the shattering of windows at buildings, for example. He's talking about healing, about talking, and saying that the media aren't really focusing on that. And he writes that Black Brunch was celebrated on social media but did not make the news. Can you tell us, what is Black Brunch?
Yeah, so Black Brunch is a tactic, a direct action tactic, and it was put together by a group of Black leaders, many of us affiliated with different organizations who are doing direct action in and around the Bay Area, and some folks who are just, you know, from the community who wanted to come together and organize with Black folks. Organize something for other Black folks, right? And so, you know, after they made the announcements that neither of the officers would be indicted in the murders of Mike Brown and Eric Garner, you know, there was a call out, basically, you know, that went out to other Black organizers, young Black leaders around Oakland. And we kind of convened together at my house, and that's kind of where Black Brunch came out of that. Was because we wanted to figure out a way to organize amongst ourselves something that could be for us, but something that could also be really impactful and get, you know, a strong message across to, you know, the communities that we were going into as well. So Black Brunch is it is a tactic, and basically, you know, what we did was we went into the Rockbridge neighborhood of Oakland, and we took up space as Black folks. We went over and we marched and we protested. We went inside different establishments and restaurants where folks were eating brunch, and we interrupted their business. We read and honored the names of Black lives lost due to police violence, right? Mm-hmm. And so that was really, really about being able to honor those lives, but also about, you know, going into these communities who would otherwise not have to think about our pain, who would otherwise not have to be exposed to the pain and the daily violence that we're facing every single day, right, in predominantly wealthy or predominantly white neighborhoods. They can be disconnected from that if they so choose. And so Black Brunch was really about disrupting that and saying, no, we're not going to allow you all to continue your business because there's this extreme violence and atrocity that's happening every single day to people who look like us, right? And so that's pretty much, you know, how Black Brunch came about.
What kind of response do you get when you go into the restaurants? What do you hear from people eating?
Well, you know, I feel like we got a range of responses. I want to keep in mind also, like, you know, because of the where we live in California, I think that there were a lot of folks there who were very open and wanted to hear what we had to say or who wanted to support that. But there were, of course, you know, people who had faces who looked like they didn't want to give us the time of day or who wanted to continue, you know, buying their food or eating their food and not really, you know, trying to pay us any mind. And then we had folks who were, you know, crying and weeping as we would, you know, as we were chanting and leaving out. So there was definitely a range of responses. And I think for the most part, it was a very overwhelmingly positive, overwhelmingly emotional response that we got back from a lot of people.
That's Wazi Moret Davis, violence prevention educator at Youth Alive and a student at San Francisco State. Claudia Pena is statewide director of the California Civil Rights Coalition. Claudia took part in a recent lawyer die-in in Los Angeles. And Kat Brooks is co-chair of the Onyx Organizing Committee. Today we are talking about the Black Lives Matter movement. How are citizens working to continue the momentum? What is the end goal and what will it take to get there? You can join us at 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. What strikes you about this movement? If you've been involved, we'd love to hear from you. You can also leave a comment, yourcallradio.org. Let's hear from Ellen in San Francisco. Hi, Ellen. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Sure.
I'm here with my comrade, Gopal. And
Ellen, if you can speak up just a bit.
Sorry. Yeah.
Perfect. Thank you.
I'm here with my comrade and friend, Gopal, and we are both a part of the Asian Solidarity crew who showed up to the Oakland Police Department in solidarity with the Black folks who have been organizing. So we wanted to call in and just, just express our love and gratitude for all the Black leadership that has been taking action in the past few weeks. Just share kind of from our experience as allies how we've been showing up.
I saw some of the photos on Twitter. I believe some of the signs said Asians for Black Lives. Is that right, if I remember correctly?
Yeah, that's right. That was the umbrella we were operating under this past Monday.
Yep, that was us.
And Ellen, can you talk a little bit about why you all decided to get involved and what the dialogue has been like?
Yeah, for us, we had been having a lot of side conversations about how Asians need to also step up for Black folks in this moment and the Black comrades that we know and love, and that it's time to, you know, a lot of folks came out with some really powerful statements from different communities, and, you know, the Asian community is very diverse, so we heard voices from South Asian communities, Southeast Asian communities, and others, but it was time to get step up past the statements and actually take action. And for us, it's not only is our liberation tied to the liberation of Black folks, but also we understand that in a relative general term, we hold a relative privilege in this country in relation to Black communities, and that a lot of that privilege and wealth has been built on the oppression of Black folks. So it's important that we stood up in a way that was really in deep accountability with the Black leadership of the action.
I'm looking at one photo of a group with a sign, End the War on Black People, hashtag Asians for Black Lives, standing in front of the Oakland Police Department.
Yeah, hi Rose, this is Gopal. I'm here with Ellen, and I wanted to build on that. I think Kat really raised this, and I think it's really important that this is not just about the police shootings of Black folk in America. This is actually about a war being waged against Black folks in the United States and around the world, and everything is used as a weapon of war against Black folks. It's where we put polluting facilities, it's who gets liquor stores instead of grocery stores, or even land to grow and control food. Mm-hmm. It's who gets substandard housing, who gets predatory mortgages, who gets evicted. It's about who gets crappy voting machines and who gets voter suppression. And it's about who gets shot with the guns that we pay for. And so for us, one of the things that I think makes this moment very different is that folks from all different social movements, people who care about a whole bunch of different issues, are coming to realize that the path to everything we need in this world, the path to climate justice, the path to food justice, the path to democracy in our country, travels through Black liberation. And without that, we can't get it. That's why when Black Lives Matter, all lives will matter.
And Gopal, we have to go to break soon, but just quickly, can you name just one or two Asian organizations that are behind Asian for Black Lives for listeners who might be interested?
Sure. Well, a bunch of us came as individuals from a variety of different organizations.
Actually, Gopal, hold that thought. I have to take a quick break. This is your call, and we'll be back after this.
Call on Local Public Radio, a show that relies on engaged listeners. We invite you to join today's conversation by calling toll-free 866-798-TALK. toll-free 866-798-8255. You can also post your question or comment at yourcallradio.org or send us an email, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Coming up at 11 o'clock, World Have Your Say from the BBC. At noon today, it's Bina. And then this afternoon at 1, David LaTulipe and Open Air.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, it's our media roundtable. We'll discuss coverage of President Obama's historic announcement to reestablish relations with Cuba. So if you have any media questions on that, of course, it's getting wall-to-wall coverage today. We will also talk about the $1.1 trillion budget deal, which affects everything from abortion to campaign finance. Who is reporting on the details of the deal, especially the budget cuts and the banking provisions supported by Wall Street? That is tomorrow. And if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today, we are talking about the exploding Black Lives Matter movement. There are actions happening almost daily. It's almost hard to keep up. Today, public defenders in five California counties are hosting rallies. It's the first of its kind. We've seen medical students, law students, young students, athletes, people from across the country are speaking out on this issue. And we're talking today, how is the movement going to keep the momentum going? What is the end goal? What will it take to get there? We're joined by Kat Brooks, co-chair of the Onyx Organizing Committee, Claudia Pena, statewide director of the California Civil Rights Coalition, Wazi Moret Davis is violence prevention educator at Youth Alive and a student at SF State. And if you'd like to join us, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org. Gopal, we've got full lines, but I just wanted to get just a few names of the organizations.
Sure, yeah.
Or Ellen. Hi.
Hi. So we just one is that we have a Tumblr that was created for our kind of solidarity group. It's Asians, you know, the number four, blacklives.tumblr.com if you want to see more information about us. And just to name a couple of the organizations who showed up in this crew, Asian Pacific Environmental Network, Chinese Progressive Association, some that are not nonprofits that are anti-imperialist organizations like Hobok, which is hella organized Bay Area Koreans, a Filipino anti-imperialist group and others. So we all came together, and many individuals also who came.
Great. Well, Ellen and Gopal, thank you so much for calling in.
Thank you, and big props to the Black leadership in this movement, in particular the Black women and queer leadership that's really been making this a different kind of movement.
All right, well, thank you for calling. Let's go next to Stuart in San Francisco. Hi, Stuart.
Hi, good morning. I was involved in the civil rights movement in the 60s, and I knew I won, if you will, when Black people got to eat at a lunch counter or went to a desegregated school or sat anywhere they felt like in a bus. What now? I mean, what practical terms do we know we won this time?
Claudia, do you want to take that one first?
Yeah, could you repeat it? I couldn't hear him that well.
Well, he was just talking about practical terms. What do we want this time? We've got a similar email from Rob who says, how do we make this not just a movement, but a movement with political traction? How do we transform this movement?
Well, sure. I mean, I can definitely answer that question, but I'm sure Kat and Wazi have some really important things to say in terms of what the community demands are. As I'm a policymaker, and my work lately has been checking out on the internet what the demands from the different towns are, checking out the Ferguson demands, seeing what Staten Island is saying, because I think that what we need to do as policymakers is be informed by what the community wants, right? It doesn't make any sense for people that are drafting laws and trying to pass laws to do it in a vacuum and to not have any information from folks on the ground. And so I hosted a meeting yesterday, a statewide meeting on ways to legislatively address police brutality, which is just one part of this movement, right? Mm-hmm. And many of the ideas on the table came from demands in different parts of the country. So some of the things that we're looking at in California, which is really important, is because of the Peace Officers' Bill of Rights, which is part of our penal code, and because of a state Supreme state Supreme Court case called Copley Press, we don't have access to information on the behavior of law enforcement in California. All of that is private. So we don't get access to a police officer's history, whether there have been complaints, whether they've been involved in shootings. We don't get access to names of people involved unless the department wants to divulge that information. Mm. All of that is protected, and we actually have the most restrictive laws in California than almost anywhere in the entire country, even more restrictive than Texas.
Wow.
So that's one of the things that we want to take on, because, of course, we can't start to address what's going on unless we have the information, right? That's why Congress just recently passed a bill that is going to require local police departments to give information over to the federal government about every shooting and death that takes place at the hands of a police officer, including the victim's race and gender, which is really important. Now, that information won't start to be collected for a few years, but it's a few years out. But these are still important policies to put into place as a response to what's going on.
And Claudia, why is it so difficult to get that information in California? What's the history behind that?
Well, so there's the Penal Code that was put into place, which is often referred to as the Peace Officers Bill of Rights. There's some confidentiality stuff in there, and I'm sure that was a product of the police union. You hear a lot of people in California talking about how strong the lobbying efforts are of the police union, and that is right on point. They do have a lot of power. And then, of course, there's the California Supreme Court case, and so we're going to need to address that with legislation. I think that part of why that information is concealed and part of why it's restricted is because it's an old boys club, right? They want to be able to keep their information to themselves and keep it private and not be accountable to the public, because they don't recognize that they are supposed to protect and serve the public. And part of protecting and serving is being transparent and is being open and being accountable. So there's a culture shift that's needed.
Hmm.
And there's a lot of things that are going to play into shifting that culture, and the organizing part of it is a huge part.
It seems like this is already getting traction. We're going to do a show about this in the new year. The Chronicle had a piece on Sunday, calls grow to eliminate grand jury secrecy in police killings. And according to this piece, the California Black Caucus will meet early next month to discuss potential legislation, including whether grand juries should be permitted to review cases involving police officers.
That's right. So one of the important things to note is that there's no panacea, right? You're going to hear that a lot from a lot of folks, that there's no one law or no one policy that can be passed to solve all of these issues. So there's going to be different steps that are coming from different parts. And as Senator Holly Mitchell she recently said when we get back in session, there's going to be a lot of bills that are related to this. So, yes, the eliminating grand juries is a big deal. In California, we don't tend to use them as much, it seems like. I'm not a public defender, so I don't know. But it seems that preliminary hearings are used more often. But it is absolutely the case that if a grand jury is used, at the very least, the evidence and all the testimony should be made public. All of that should be transparent. There should be no secret grand juries.
That is Claudia Pena, statewide director of the California Civil Rights Coalition. Wazi Murat Davis, violence prevention educator at Youth Alive, how would you answer those questions that we're receiving from listeners about the end goals?
Yeah, so I think the one thing to keep in mind here is that, and me personally, I don't believe in solutions necessarily, because the issues that we have going on right now are so deeply entrenched systematically, systemically, and psychologically in the people in this community that, there is no one-track solution, so to say. There is no one-track tangible result, right? And so I think that we need to address it from all different angles at all different levels, because the issues are multifaceted and interconnected. As, Claudia mentioned before, it's important for people to recognize how their role in, maybe it could be their job or the community that they live in, but how all of these things, all of these institutions are connected and perpetuate the oppression of certain people in different ways. I think that the results and the end goals are going to look, a lot of different ways. Personally, I'll say right now that, we know folks like the Black Organizing Project who have been working to remove security officers, police, from outside of Oakland schools, right?
Mm.
There are folks who are working to demilitarize, police in local communities. I think that another conversation that needs to happen is, like, the, you know, violence shows up in different ways, right? And so it's not always just police brutality. It's not always just police violence. But if you want to talk about also the violence of, like, gentrification, for instance, that we see happening. I saw it happen in my hometown back in D.C., back in Maryland. And now I'm living here, and I see the effects of gentrification, you know, pushing the black community further and further out of their traditional neighborhoods, pushing them further away from jobs, placing them in jails, you know, all these different things. This is all a form of violence, right? And I think that, you know, we have to address these different forms of violence in a lot of different ways. So, you know, it's going to look like a lot more dialogue, a lot more conversation, and a lot more education. But it's also going to look like, you know, making moves politically through different policies and whatnot. Because, you know, a lot of folks in the communities also don't know about, you know, policies such as, or historic issues such as, like, redlining of different communities or, like, gang injunctions, and the way that a lot of these things are, you know, historically racist. Mm-hmm. And have been used to for the genocide of black people in their own communities. So I think that we need definitely a lot more education, you know, on a lot of these different things in all communities. And so at least what I'm excited about for what's been happening with our movement is that I feel like we're making a call for people in all different types of communities to educate themselves and also to go back into their communities and begin that education, you know, because I think that half the fight is psychological. Half of it is mental, you know. So
that's Wazi Murat Davis, violence prevention educator at Youth Alive and student at SF State. And before we get to calls, I wanted also to get your perspective on this, Kat.
Right. So I think the end goal, like the ideal for all of us that I don't know that any of us would see in our lifetime is really getting the boots of the state off of the neck of black people and mm-hmm. to give us room to breathe so that we can build self-sustaining communities. And in order for that to happen, we're talking about a revolutionary transformation of consciousness that in this country holds very deeply rooted racist belief systems, and as well as revolutionary transformations in policies and practices. I really loved how Gopal talked about it in terms of, you know, education and housing and climate change, all of that stuff. The policies and practices in this country that leave black people at the bottom, in jail, locked up, miseducated, pushed out of their communities, are dead. Right, and the way that we get there is by building a sustainable movement, and that's really about the work that happens when the cameras go home. And those are one of the significant conversations that are happening now. What organizations or formations that are going to go back to the grassroots work of door knocking and building collective consensus and creating local agendas that tie into state agendas, that tie into national agendas, and keep us pushing. Right, it's about stopping chasing dead bodies and getting on the offensive rather than the defensive, so that we can breathe, and that there's an awareness. This country tends to deny the reality of black people, right, that we are somehow holding on to something from 400 years ago, and why don't we just let it go? If we could just figure out how to eradicate that deeply rooted racist belief system, I think a lot of very important work could get done.
And that is Kat Brooks, co-chair of the Onyx Organizing Committee, an African liberation organization dedicated to the empowerment of all people of color. And thanks again for the calls and the emails. We have an email from Nita who says, I was honored to attend the gathering at the Third Baptist Church last week. All the community leaders were inspiring. At one point, the Honorable Reverend Brown invited those in the community, starting with the mothers who had suffered the loss of children due to police violence, and fully half of the attendees were standing. That is what the movement is about, the decimation of black families. It's tragic, it's a cost to communities, and the overwhelming necessity to take an honest look at its systemic roots. Thank you for the email, Nita. And you can email us feedback@yourcallradio.org. You can also give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. Let's go next to Joseph in Berkeley. Hi, Joseph.
Yes, good morning. I had a question about avoiding the movement being co-opted, but I just want to say in one sentence, I think all the blockades are great, but instead of activists expending arrest blockading highways late at night that just merely inconveniences the motorists, that blockades ought to be done during rush hour and in financial districts to interrupt the capitalist need. My question about co-opting In my online commentary, Karmic Justice by Joseph Anderson, I said, the good blacks, especially top black politicians, will at best once again call for some kind of touchy-feely police sensitivity training and so-called dialogue, but never for the best training, quick effective prosecutions, sound convictions, and serious criminal sentences against rogue and killer cops. And I would also add independent federal prosecutors. So I'm wondering how we keep this movement from being co-opted by the older so-called responsible blacks who oppose even nonviolent blockades of highways and buildings.
Yes.
Who would like to take that one?
I would like to start with that, actually, and just highlight the event that happened last night at BB. That the community was at the very last moment alerted of and invited. I had elected officials calling me and saying, oh, could you outreach the policymakers and the clergy you're putting on this event? And my response was, no, I am not going to disrespect the community by reaching out to them 24 hours before an event so that you can somehow validate this event that you're having that has once again made the community the afterthought. And so that's one way, right? We have to have the courage to stand up. Mm-hmm. And if what the policymakers are bringing toward us doesn't look right, we have to be able to say to them, no, that doesn't look right. And then there were people that spoke last night that stood up and called that event out for what it was, right? The fact that the people that were actually in the streets that have been doing this work were not invited to be a part of that process. And that takes courage and it takes determination. And we have to be able to communicate that even to our own people and our own communities about, yes, this looks like change, it looks like transformation, but being able to highlight what is the difference between real change and real transformation and something that is being offered to us to placate us, shut us up, and send us home.
Huh. I was struck by the rally in Washington, D.C. There were a number of speakers, and
yes,
some young women from Ferguson, a young woman from Ferguson took the mic and said, we're here, why don't you let us speak? And
mm-hmm.
then the crowd started saying, let them speak, let them speak. And there was some disarray. The organizers weren't really sure what to do, and they ultimately did speak. So what were your thoughts on that? And you know what? I mean, it's interesting to look at like what people are saying about Al Sharpton, and maybe it's time for him to step aside and let other people. I don't want to say take that place, but you know what I mean. I mean, the people from Ferguson said, "We're here. Well, why weren't we invited? Why aren't you talking to us?"
We need to stop allowing the state to define for us what our leadership is. And I would agree that if Sharpton is really in solidarity with the community, then he should heed the calls. From not just younger people, but younger people and some older folks that have been in the movement, you know, to step aside. And yes, if we're not going to be given space, we have to take it. We are going to have to assert ourselves. This is our movement. We're doing the work, and you're going to hear us.
All right. Well, anyone else want to comment on that before we go to our next caller?
I'd just like to say a little bit about that. You know, I definitely agree with everything that Kat was saying, and I feel like, you know, what happened in D.C. is very unfortunate, the way that they even set up that event. You know, they had a VIP section, okay, for Al Sharpton, you know what I'm saying? Where he was separated from the entire crowd that was out there, you know what I'm saying, that was supposed to be there in unison as one collectively for the Millions March D.C., right? And so that just kind of, even just that one detail shows you the true disconnect that exists between, you know what I'm saying, one generation and the next. Hmm. And I think it's important to recognize difference. It's important to recognize that, you know, we are in a different time. And for me, myself, as a young person who's in this movement, I think it's also important to draw back on history and to learn from our past, right, and to learn from our elders and our ancestors. And at the same time, it is important to recognize that, you know, as time goes along, the issues, you know, we're fighting for the same things, but, you know, the issues are looking differently and the faces are looking different, right? And so right now what we're seeing is it's mostly black youth who are most affected by a lot of the violence, especially from police brutality, right? And so, you know, for that event in D.C., for Al Sharpton to create this dissonance in this way and to completely just take over the event in this way, in the same way that he was trying to push himself onto the family in New York, into their funeral plans, you know, making himself the lead speaker, like, when they didn't even ask him to, you know. It's just, you know, little things like that. You have to leave room for people, and for young people especially, to be able to use our voice into bringing new tactics and creative tactics that we can apply to the older ones, the historical ones, you know, because the older ones, they're not necessarily going to work the same way today that they did back then, but we can certainly draw on them and create new creative and critical, you know, methods of organizing.
Wazi Moret Davis helped organize the Black Brunch and shut down OPD direct actions. Wazi is violence prevention educator at Youth Alive. Kat Brooks is co-chair of the Onyx Organizing Committee. Kat has participated in a number of actions, including the BART shutdown and the four-hour occupation of the OPD. Claudia Pena is statewide director of the California Civil Rights Coalition. Claudia took part in this week's lawyer die-in on the courthouse steps in Los Angeles. And we've got time for a few more calls. Thanks again, Joseph. Let's go to Margaret and Salinas. Hi, Margaret. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. And thank you, lady, for all the hard work that you're doing. Thank you, Rose, for having these programs. I'm in Salinas, and we've had shootings just in the past year. This year, we've had 5 officer-involved deaths, 4 of them shot, no weapons. The last one was tasered. An hour later, the guy had like 104 temperature. You know, I think that what's important is that there needs to be more of a linking as this progresses and moves along so that it doesn't lose its momentum. As an example, we had a protest here, and it was a pretty good-sized protest, and we had groups coming in from Albuquerque, from Southern California, Oxnard, Oakland, and we had all of this culminate here, and we had a pretty good-sized protest. But the city is very linked in, and there's a lot of co-opt individuals who get out within the community. Our protest was so controlled by the city, they went around taking people's signs and telling them that they couldn't hold those signs, that it was not with the message, and they would, you know, and they gave them their signs with their message. And so because we have a large community here that is, it's a Latino migrant population, some undocumented, some generational, and there's fear of the police. One of the victims was laid, like Michael, left on the street for 3.5 hours in the neighborhood where he was shot. So that instills fear. They called in police departments from Santa Clara County, Santa Cruz County, and they had riot, like what was going on. I mean, they had riot gear, people, just like what was going on in Ferguson. But we don't get the news because of the good old boy system that controls everybody. And so I've tried to keep this. I've been working with the attorney Burris, with families here, trying to do something about this. We've gone to Department of Justice, and we've made certain requests. I heard a mention of the police departments and the data collection, so making moves, cameras. But for all the moves that we make here, they sort of come out and they get their co-opt groups together and they say, oh, we're doing this. Oh, we're doing that.
Well, Margaret,
so I think it's very, well, if I can offer what I believe is an important next step, which would be you've got to be linking in with other groups beyond, because there are a lot of cities that are being left out of the conversation where there is oppression. You know, for example, Albuquerque, here in Salinas, I think Oxnard, they've had a lot of...
Well, Margaret, you just gave us a couple good show ideas, including what steps can you take when something like this happens. So thank you for calling. I hate to cut you off, but a bunch of people have been patiently waiting. And then I'll get a few more calls, and then I'll get final thoughts from our guests. Thank you for calling. Let's go to Harry in San Francisco. Hi, Harry.
Hi, yes. Good morning, Rose. I wanted to ask your guests if they had any comment on the Board of Supervisors' rejection of some statement. I'm not sure clear what it was. Supervisor John Avalos was putting it forward. The police union objected strenuously to any sort of resolution, evidently, and Malia Cohen pulled her support, as well as did London Breed, the two African-American supervisors. Also, Supervisor Norman Yee failed to support this. And
okay.
There were only four supervisors who were supporting this, so... Do you have any comments about this type of police union sort of putting a lot of pressure on governments?
All right. Wazi, you're in San Francisco. Are you familiar with this?
Well, I live in Oakland and I work in Oakland.
Okay.
I haven't heard about this and as of yet, but it's giving me something to look up right now, actually.
All right, Harry. We'll look into that, and we're going to continue doing shows on this, so we'll bring it up in the future. Let's take one more caller, Mimi in Monterey. Hi, Mimi. Welcome to the show.
Yes, can you?
Mimi?
Hello?
Hi, go ahead.
Yeah.
If you can please be brief.
I'll be very fast. I wanted to respond. There was a comment that came up a couple of times in reference to a lot of times black folks are told that we are suffering or are reliving something that happened to us over 400 years ago and that we have to get past it or get over it because it's in the past. But the thing is that that is actually true. These are ramifications from slavery and from Jim Crow. And I think it's very important that every black movement that is a part of this needs to look up H.R. 194. It is a House of Representatives resolution that was done in 2008, and it actually outlines the fact that African Americans or people of African descent in this country are suffering the results from slavery and Jim Crow, and a lot of the things that we're suffering economically, financially,
All right, Mimi, thank you for calling. We're actually going to discuss that in the new year, right when we come back. So thank you for calling. We've got only about a minute left. Quick final thoughts from all of you. Claudia, where do you hope to see this going?
Oh, I just hope it doesn't stop. I mean, all these actions and all these protests and the community movement that's going on, it can't stop. It just, I hope it just keeps going until there's full liberation for all folks of color, for all folks that are oppressed by the system in place.
Kat, 20 seconds.
Sure. I think that a natural evolution from Black Lives Matter has been around Black Power mattering and how we are given the room to create self-determination in our own communities. And if you're not in an organization, start one or join one. That's the way we sustain this movement.
And Wazi, final thoughts?
I'm just really looking forward to what I think is going to be a mass movement, a mass revolution. That's going to create some real change. So I'm just looking forward to keep working with my folks and in the justice of black leadership,
All right. Well, we're starting a new series on these issues. We're going to continue this conversation come January. Wazi Murett Davis is violence prevention educator at Youth Alive and a student at SF State and an organizer. Claudia Pena, statewide director of the California Civil Rights Coalition, and Kat Brooks is co-chair of the Onyx Organizing Committee. Thank you all for joining us.
Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. On the next Your Call, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. This week, we'll discuss coverage of President Obama's historic announcement to reestablish relations with Cuba. We'll also talk about the $1.1 trillion budget deal affecting everything from abortion to campaign finance. Who's reporting on the deal's budget cuts and banking provisions supported by Wall Street? We'll be joined by The Huffington Post's Michael McAuliffe, investigative reporter David K. Johnston, and McClatchy's Kevin Hall. Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To listen to past shows or sign up for our podcast, visit yourcallradio.org. Becca Hoekstra produces the show, Malihe Razazan is senior producer, and Matt Martin is the executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is our studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.